You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Rochester, New York is known for many things: great food, lilacs, innovative supermarkets, minor league baseball, and unfortunately, crime. This heavily illustrated book covers some of the most spectacular crimes in the Rochester area's history, written by true crime master Michael Benson, who grew up in the town of Chilai. Read about serial killers Arthur Shawcross and Robert Bruce Bahalski, the savage murders of Kathy Bernhard and George Ann Formicola, the all-in-the-family murders of Tabitha Bryant and Jim Tan, the hunt for Bucky Phillips, the disappearance of Flossie Wilbur, plus much more, and many shocking photos. The book that we're featuring this evening is Rochester's Most Startling Crimes, with my special guest journalist and author, Michael Benson. Welcome back to the program. Thank you once again, Michael Benson.
Thanks, Dan, for having me.
Thank you. Once again, you've done it again with Rochester's Most Startling Crimes. Incredible, jam-packed with nothing but incredible, almost unbelievable murder cases and stories. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's start with...
This will probably be the last of my pandemic books. I have to start writing my post-pandemic books now.
Wow. Incredible efforts you did during that pandemic. How many books did you have published during that time?
Four or five. There's a couple in the can that won't come out until next year from Kensington Press.
Right.
But yeah,
incredible.
You stick me in a house with a typewriter, I will write.
Let's talk about this Rochester's Most Startling Crimes. Obviously, they're centered around Rochester and your experiences and growing up in the area and writing about this area now for quite a while. Let's talk about the contents of this book here, Rochester's Most Startling Crimes.
Well, we start off with the murder of Charlie Tan. Now, it's interesting. Two stories in the book feature murder victims who, for the life of me, I could not find anyone to say anything nice about them.
Yeah.
Least popular people around. Charlie Tan was one, Flossie Wilbur was the other. But Charlie Tan was apparently a mean man who ran his own company, had a lot of money, and tried to run his home in the same way, and was abusive to his wife and children. Until on January 28th, 2015, his 52-year-old wife, Jean, called 911 and complained that her husband had choked her and he was trying to kill her. The woman had just managed to say her address, which was in a really upscale street in Rochester suburb of Pittsford. When the dispatcher heard a shuffling noise and then a male voice came on the phone and said, "You'll have to excuse my wife. She's very childish. There is no emergency here." This is not the first time we've encountered a man who used the word childish to describe his wife because she was calling 911 on him. Now, the dispatcher didn't like it at all and sent a sheriff's deputy anyway. And when the deputy got there, Jean Tan declined to have her husband arrested, which is what usually happens. And the incident could hardly be regarded as a one-off because it was the 17th time the sheriff's office had been called to the Tan house, dating back to 2003. Now, a week later, Jean and Jim's 19-year-old son, Charles Tan, begins behaving unusually. This is February 5th, 2015, and the same day his friend Whitney Knickerbocker purchases a shotgun, and Charles has a series of meetings and meals with old friends, and he's exuding an uncomfortable feeling that he's saying goodbye, and this troubles his friends. At 8:40 on February 15th, Jim Tan, that's the dad, sent his final email to an employee at Dynamax, his company, and that was the last anyone heard from him. an hour and 20 minutes after the email was sent. Charlie, his son, meets up with a friend, Jacob Grossman, seems very anxious, and says to Jacob that he's going to have to be leaving the country. Now, Charlie's behavior was so abnormal that Grossman took it upon himself to call 911 and suggested that the sheriff's deputies go over to the Tan house and make sure everything's okay. And when Deputy William Connell gets to the house, they speak to Charlie, who is calmed down, and says his dad's not home, at which point Charlie Canada and stays for a couple of days. But by February 9th, he's back in Pittsburgh with his mom. And around dinner time, an email is sent to his fraternity brothers saying he's going to be having some trouble in the near future. He's waiting a visit from the authorities. And minutes later, Charles' mom picks up the phone and makes the 18th and final 911 call from the Tan home. She says, "My son shot my husband. He was trying to protect me. My husband was trying to torture me." Deputy Christopher Cooper is the first responder, gets over to the house, which is very impressive, a 2,700 square foot colonial. Charlie is outside waiting. He's ordered to the ground and handcuffed, tells the police that the body's upstairs in his dad's office, and the gun is in the garage. Now, sure enough, Jim Tan's dead from multiple shotgun blasts.
Right.
He's been shot in the chest, arm, neck, and face. He's a pile of clothes and coagulated gore, basically. But there's a surprise. There are indications of decomposition.
Mm-hmm.
The deputy expected a corpse, but a fresh one, and Jim Tan has been dead for some time. So the case becomes truly exceptional. Charlie Tan appears in court, and it becomes apparent he has a sizable fan club. His supporters call out to him. They pledge their love and allegiance with his cause. And it becomes clear to prosecutors that any attempt to prosecute Charlie Tan is going to have to deal with his supporters, and they're many. And someone said, well, it's just like Charlie Manson with his Manson family. But it wasn't, because the Manson family was on drugs and they were weirdos. Charlie Tan's fans were like the best and the brightest kids in Monroe County, as was Charlie Tan. You know, everybody who talked to him said, hey, Charlie Tan's not a good kid. He's a great kid.
Yeah.
So district attorney's office knew that sooner or later they were going to have to deal with the sentiment, and it was pervasive, that Charlie Tan killed his father because his father needed killing. And then there was the aspect of the time delay. You know, it wasn't just that it was a gruesome killing or why it was done, the Oedipal nature of it, but Charlie shot his dad long before his mother called 911. You know, mom was living with the body. So in the past, lawyers had successfully defended women who'd been accused of killing their husbands, saying that their clients suffered from battered spouse syndrome. But did that syndrome transfer to the woman's child? I mean, that was the question the jury in this case was going to have to answer. You know, psychologists weighed in. They likened Charlie's experiences to a veteran who spends too long in a war zone. It might have been post-traumatic stress that caused him to kill his dad. But wouldn't prolonged trauma also negatively influence a person's behavior? Well, in Charlie's case, maybe not so much, because he was a popular person and an excellent student. And to disassociate himself with the hell that his home life was, he overachieved. And it's fairly common compensation for a troubled home life. Now, at the trial, now the prosecution introduced into evidence a list taken from Gene's purse, listing several criminal defense attorneys. So she was thinking about defense even before she called the police. And during the defense's final argument to the jury, they brought up for the first time the possibility that Charlie's mother, Jean, had fired the fatal shot. She had the same motive and opportunity as her son, and then the lawyer pauses and says, no, she had more of a motive and more of an opportunity to pull the trigger. Well, the trial ends up in a mistrial. The deliberation by the jury is called short by Judge Piampiano. In an unusual way, the jurors are saying, no, we're making progress. No, we'll get this done. And yet he calls a mistrial and orders the trial reheld. Afterwards, the jury said that we were leaning to acquit. So it means that the judge probably pulled the plug for fear that there was going to be an acquittal and Charlie was going to walk free. Now, what happened after that, even more bizarre, Charlie goes back to Canada, and when he comes back into the country for a special event, he's arrested by the federal government and for gun charges, and he's convicted at that trial and sentenced to 20 years in federal penitentiary for the shotgun. It's a large, large sentence for a gun charge. It's more like they were trying to get back at him for getting away with murder, which is how I think they felt about it. Well, but and the appeals were just beginning, and the pandemic began. And presumably there will be Charlie Tan court appearances in the future as they try to perhaps lessen the federal charges, if not getting him off entirely.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was the first story. That's exciting enough that there's, what, six, seven mm-hmm. more in the book.
You talk about the next chapter. It's called Artie, and you're referring to Arthur Shawcross. And we've spoken about him and his crimes before. We can't go through that entire story, but just give us a brief synopsis of the chapter that is Artie itself. So some of the features of this extraordinary criminal.
Well, we have spoken about Arthur Shawcross in the past because he is a suspect in the 1966 murders of Georgianne Formicola and Kathy Bernhardt.
Right.
And one of the reasons he's such a good suspect for those crimes is that he came to Rochester in the early 70s. He had been arrested in Watertown, New York, where he grew up, and where he murdered two children, a little boy and a little girl. And because of courtroom vagaries and weirdnesses and deals and this and that, he was charged with only one of the murders. Killed two kids, was only charged with one of them, and ended up being sentenced only 10 years and was never tried for the other crime. So here he is. He's done 10 years. He's a child killer, and they want to release him back into the world. New York State Department of Corrections had a problem. They kept putting him in little towns that were similar to the towns he grew up in where they thought he'd thrive. But the instant somebody found out who he was, there would be, you know, near riots. He was chased out of town 3-4 times, at least once by a potential lynch mob.
Yeah.
So the Department of Corrections had to do something with this guy. So they dropped him in downtown Rochester and didn't even tell the Rochester police he was there.
Wow.
So what followed was so predictable and maybe even could have been nipped in the bud if the authorities had spoken to one another instead of trying to just, you know, ditch this guy because he's a problem in a place where maybe nobody will ask any questions. So, yeah, the trouble started September 11th, 1988. That's his first murder. That's Anna Marie Steffen. Or no, his first murder is Dorothy Marie Dotsie Blackburn, 27 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And most of his victims from then on are they're sex workers, street women, not exclusively. One of them was just mentally disabled and a friend of his. But they were women he could easily get into his car and then take them someplace and kill them. He left the first few bodies near bodies of water. The first one was near Salmon Creek in Northampton Park in the town of Sweden, which is a suburb of Rochester. Second one was along the banks of the Genesee River Gorge, as was the third. There were, from then on, a few were left near the river, not necessarily down in the embankments to the gorge, but near the top of the gorge. He killed Patty Ives, killed June Stotts. You know, Stotts was the one who was neither a streetwalker nor a drug addict. She was a slow and perhaps slightly schizophrenic woman who and ended up going down to the river's bank with Artie and ended up dead. Weirdness, he removed her vagina and claimed to have later eaten it.
Yeah.
Which, again, tied in with 1966 because of the sexual mutilation of those bodies. Maria Welch, 22, was next, November 1989. You know, she had the letters L-O-V-E on the knuckles of her left hand. Franny Brown of Otis Street in Rochester, she's next. The person who found her was praying that it was only a mannequin, but he knew it wasn't.
Yeah.
29-year-old Elizabeth Liz Gibson, November 25th, 1989. They're coming along much quicker now. He's found what he likes to do, and he's doing it regularly. And we get to Darlene Trippi, June Cicero, Felicia Stevens. And then a jogger finds the final victim's boots in a park. And by this time, the police know they have a serial killer who's killing sex workers for the most part, and he is revisiting their bodies. He's having sex
That's
with
right.
the bodies. He's cutting them up. So they don't release the news that the boots have been found, and instead they keep a constant surveillance on the area. And sure enough, Artie comes out to play, and he's spotted by a helicopter standing over the body with his penis in his hand, and that's it. He's done.
Incredible.
So that's Arthur Shawcross. And he is, you know, he's Rochester's number one villain. So no book about Rochester's most startling crimes would be complete without him. Even though I dealt with other aspects of his criminal career, possible other aspects, and I thought that giving the main reason why he is famous in Rochester was important to put in this book, and that was the 11 murders of 1989.
Yeah. Let's use that opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about not having any book about Rochester murders. In fact, true crime legend Arthur Shawcross. But you also have a couple guys that you cover in your book, Killer Twins, Robert Bruce Spahalski and his brother Stephen. And this is another must-have inclusive about Rochester, but also, again, a couple maybe not as well known, but certainly has all the ingredients of a true crime legendary stories, especially these guys being identical twins and killer twins as well. So you do cover Robert Bruce Spahalski, very incredible story in this book.
Yeah, well, what happens is, and I'm still visiting Rochester fairly steadily at this time. My kids are little. My parents are still alive. We'll go up there to visit Grandma and Grandpa. And I was around when Spahalski was arrested. And I was around several months later and reading in the newspaper that the killings hadn't stopped. Some, you know, either somebody was taking Shawcross's place or there was more than one person killing women to begin with. But the senseless murders of women in Rochester did not stop when Shawcross was arrested. And Robert Bruce Spahalski was one of the reasons why. He'd grown up a ne'er-do-well in Elmira, New York. He did time for stealing stuff. And just like Shawcross, once he finished a long stint, they placed him in Rochester where they thought he might be able to assimilate into society and straighten out his act. Didn't work out that way. On December 31st, 1990, a Sunday, this is the 24 hours before New Year's, not New Year's, sex worker Moraine Armstrong is turning a trick in her Lake Avenue apartment, and she was heard to scream. About 12 hours later, Rochester police are called, and Moraine's friend, who'd found the body, called and said she was hanging. When they got there, she wasn't hanging. She was on the bed with electric appliance cords tied tightly around her neck. Now, I spoke to Detective Frank Campione. He and I went to the same school for a year. And he knew that at a crime scene like this, he was there. You had to keep your eyes and ears open for that guy who's just a little bit too interested in what's going on, a little too curious in an antsy way. Police called it the witness who had his belly button against the police tape. So on January 1st, he's working the Lake Avenue crime scene. Sure enough, there's a guy. He's fascinated by what's going on. He's kind of antsy. He's a nervous guy. Says his name is Robert Spahalski. He's 36 years old. And says that he didn't really know Moraine, but he'd seen her around. But he sure was interested in what happened to her. So it's that case came and went, became cold right away. All of the witnesses were on drugs and in different states of being brain-addled, and leads ended up evaporating. And came to be almost 7 months later, July 21st, 1991. And it's one of the hottest days of the year. And Officer Gerald Smith is on Emerson Street in the city of Rochester to do a wellness check. And he's just a block away from where Maureen Armstrong was killed. So he's parks his car and looks out, and he sees this little entourage of neighbors coming towards his car with grim expressions on their faces. And he says, "What's the matter?" And they go, "Foul odor. There's a foul odor coming from that house, from the front apartment." So he crosses the street, and he sees something. It's so grisly that, you know, it gives him the willies to think about it for the rest of his life. The side window to the front apartment is covered on the outside with a black blanket of flies.
Yeah, right.
Flies that want in.
Mm-hmm.
And, yikes, you know there's nothing good in there. They finally open up the house, and it's just unbelievable odor. And the body of Adrian Berger is on the floor there, so decomposed they would never be able to determine how she died. The interesting thing about that was that her boyfriend was a kind of a dirtbag type named Robert Bruce Spahalski.
Yeah.
So Spahalski makes money for a while turning all male tricks, and among his pickups was an otherwise respectable Rochesterian named Charles Grandi, who had the misfortune of inviting Spahalski into his home on Tuesday, October 1st, 1991. So this is a couple months after Adrian Berger. Excuse me. And Spahalski thought that Grandi was rich because he was a landscaper. Grandi wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But Spahalski had a very limited perception of what true affluence was. So he takes Spahalski home with him. Spahalski tries to rob him, ends up hitting him over the head with a hammer and caving his head in. He steals Grandi's car, picks up a woman, and he's stopped by a police officer in Grandi's car with a sex worker in the front seat with him. And he shows Grandi's license to the policeman.
Yeah.
The policeman hands it back and doesn't sense that anything's wrong. Grandi's a guy who's 5'8", and Spahalski's a huge, he's 6'3", completely muscular. If he and his twin had stuck with it and hadn't gone bad, they might have been Olympic gymnasts. I mean, they were in really good shape. Spahalski
right.
once broke a pair of handcuffs, though, right off his wrist by snapping them with his strength.
Yeah.
So anyway, the cop doesn't notice that this guy's twice the size of the person on the driver's license. And when police finally track down Spahalski, they can't arrest him for the murder of Grandi. They don't have enough evidence. But they arrest him instead of criminal impersonation. And he gets off because the jury refuses to believe that a policeman could be so stupid as to mistake a 5'8 guy for a 6'4 guy. And,
well,
Spahalski walks out. And now, I was pen pals with Spahalski for many years, claimed, swore up and down, that for the next 10 years or so, he didn't kill anybody. There was a lady who lived in one of his apartment buildings who was strangled to death, and somebody turned up the thermostat all the way. just as had happened at Charles Grandi's house, in an attempt to speed up decomposition. But anyway, he claims that wasn't him, and there wasn't enough evidence to arrest him, so what are you going to do? But his next kill is when he is smoking crack with his friend Vivian in his apartment on Spencer Street in the city of Rochester. And he smokes so much crack, and of course this is his story, that he sees Vivian Irizarry turn into a demon. So he sets about vanquishing her. He hits her over the head with a hammer. He strangles her and kills her. And then when his hallucination lifts, he realizes he's killed his best friend. And he puts her in the basement where it's cool. Maybe he can slow down decomposition. But he's in a jam because he's HIV positive. He's on drugs. He doesn't have the wherewithal to move the body anywhere. So his only bet, his only chance of surviving is to turn himself in. And that's what he does. He walks into the police department on November 8th, 2005 and confesses to all four murders. But I've always suspected that Robert Bruce Bohalski was responsible for more than just four.
It's very interesting correspondence you have with him as well. He does impart a lot of detailed and graphic, you call it almost pornographic description.
Well, you know, and I didn't share all of it because I thought some of it was just exploiting the victims in ways that they didn't deserve.
Right.
But, yeah, he committed sex crimes and would describe both the sex and the murder in pornographic detail. Just, you know, he's creating his own, you know, entertainment form, apparently, entertains him. But I edited it because I can't imagine a civilized reader really needing some of that stuff. You
no,
get the idea.
No.
You can imagine.
It's interesting, too, when you talk about the most, when he describes as a glorious reunion with his brother, Stephen, and why you call them a killer twins is because, well, not only did they both kill, but they both killed with a hammer as well.
They killed identically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The old question of nurture or nature. These guys didn't see one another after, as free men, they didn't see one another past being teenagers. A couple of times they were both incarcerated in the same prison. But they didn't have a lot of influence on each other as adults, not zero. So the fact that they grew up to kill in identical fashion is pretty astounding. It makes me think that, yes, someday we're going to find the evil gene. We're going to find what chromosome or lack of chromosome causes people to be psychopathic. And, you know, we may be able to isolate the evil gene. And I guess if you want to look far in the future, eliminate it and make the world a nicer place. But, yeah, I think it's not just horrible upbringings that make evil people. It is something in their makeup from birth.
You have an interesting story. You say that not since Escape from Dannemora has been an escape story excited you to write about. And this is about Ralph Bucky Phillips. Tell us what about this unique story or this unique escape story, why you felt compelled to include it in this book.
Well, the appeal of a good outlaw on the run story is constant. Everybody loves a good escape from prison and fleeing story because it's a combination of daring do and desperation. You don't know how the story is going to come out. Somebody's going to lose. You know, almost always somebody dies because you have a man on the run and an army of law enforcement searching for him. It always makes for a great Johnny Cash song, any escape from prison story. So I was intrigued by the Ralph Bucky Phillips story from the start. Made national news, had staying power. But when Richard Matt and David Sweat escaped from the Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora during the spring of 2015, I was lucky enough to be assigned to write the book for the University Press of New England. And I spent the better part of 6 months investigating that story, which in some ways resembled this one. So I put off writing about Bucky until now. Bucky, he escaped from a jail near the Alden Correctional Facility where he was sentenced, using his wits and a can opener. Now, the bizarre thing right off the bat, now, the Alden Correctional Facility is in Erie County. That's westernmost New York State, you know, almost Pennsylvania or Ohio. Now, bizarrely, Bucky took off only 4 days before the end of his 90-day sentence for parole violation.
Yeah, incredible.
So he needed out. It was like a panic attack. He needed out, and he got out. And he was, for the next few months, perhaps at his happiest. I mean, Bucky's dad had been a mean drunk. He'd run away frequently as a kid. When he ran away, he would have to get away from his mean dad. He'd run through the woods, sometimes 15 miles from Casadaga to Jamestown to go to his aunt's house. So he knew how to go long distances without ever having to use the road. And one thing he had going for him, even when he was little, is he wasn't afraid of the dark. So Bucky grew up bad, always in trouble, stealing stuff mostly, lots of time in jail, had never really hurt anybody, but now he's freaked out, he's escaped from jail, and he's on the run. And at first, state police just didn't care that much. I mean, he's cutting 4 days off of a parole violation sentence. If the guy wants to go home that badly 4 days early, you know, let him.
Right.
But there was a search. And there was also, and this is interesting because this is not that far in the past. It's only, 6 years ago. But there's the assumption. There's just the assumption that because Bucky Phillips has Native American blood in him, that he is an expert outdoorsman, that this gives him a intrinsic superiority over his predominantly white pursuers in the woods because he can read trails and use the moss on trees as a compass. And
sure,
all of it, you know, there was absolutely no truth in it whatsoever. Bucky was looking to steal a hot car and outrun you. You know, he didn't really care that much about the moss on the trees.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the search for Bucky is a little bit lackadaisical until he decides to throw himself a party one night and gets inebriated and is driving erratically in Chemung County, which is where Elmira is, crossing the double yellow in the wee hours of the morning, and picks up a cop car. Saturday morning, 12:50 a.m., June 10th, 2006. We're in Veteran, New York. 30-year-old state trooper Sean Brown and his partner Donald Will. They're patrolling Route 13. Brown's driving. And the troopers saw a suspicious vehicle on Parrot Road, hot car, a Mustang. And the car was in front of them looking like it had just left the tavern parking lot. And, you know, police who patrol the roads, you know, have a sixth sense for a tipsy driver. So they decide to investigate. Brown is married. He's a father of two. He's a trooper since 2002. Puts on the flashing lights, taps the siren a couple of times, and the swerving car obediently pulls over. Now, they followed procedure. Will is 6 months Brown's junior on the force, so he gets out and approaches the car on the passenger's side. Brown approaches the driver's side, and Brown's closer to the car when a gun from the driver's side comes out the window, shoots Brown in the abdomen, and knocks Brown down. Gun pulls back inside the car. Car speeds away, and neither trooper has a chance to see the license number. Will drags Brown back into the car, takes the wheel, and drives his bleeding partner to St. Joseph's Hospital. Brown goes into surgery, comes out conscious and lucid. Well, the lackadaisical nature of the hunt for Bucky Phillips just went right out the window. You know, from here on out, he shot a cop. Now it's serious business. And a cat and mouse game starts all over the southern tier of New York State. And Bucky leaves breadcrumbs for manhunters because he steals and then abandons cars pretty frequently. You know, one place he robbed was a gun store, and that, again, that got cops nervous because what's she going to use all these weapons for? They do, the police do an interesting thing. They put under surveillance and even arrest members of Bucky's family so that they cannot give Bucky aid. You can't go home is the message. And on Saturday night, June 17th, 1 week after the shooting of Trooper Brown, the Bucky Phillips case goes big time, goes national, when it's featured on America's Most Wanted TV show. And there's Bucky Mania. Folks being who they are, looking to make a buck, whatever they can. There's a lot of commerce generated by Bucky Phillips' notoriety. Bars in particular, into all things Bucky. There's Bucky drinks. There's T-shirts, where's Bucky, got Bucky. And the most popular T-shirt, Run, Bucky, Run.
Yeah.
Now, some thought it was a riot. Some thought it was in bad taste. After all, poor Trooper had been shot. And at the beginning of August, after almost 2 months in the hospital, Sean Brown has healed enough to get out and return to work. And he joins the hunt for the man who shot him. The case takes another serious step into tragedy. At 6:10 p.m. on Thursday, August 31st, two troopers are shot down in an ambush by Bucky. They're brought in with gunshot wounds. One of the wounded men was brought to Brooks Memorial near Fredonia. The other was flown to Erie County Medical Center, Buffalo. One was in critical condition, had been shot in the leg, and apparently shot through that artery that bleeds out,
right,
and was near death when he was found. So the two wounded troopers are 32-year-old Joseph Longobardo and 38-year-old Donald Baker Jr., and Bucky is the only suspect. I mean, there's just nobody out there shooting troopers except for Bucky.
That's right.
And the chances of him being taken alive would seem at this point to be practically nil. I would think, you know, if you had asked a candid trooper at that point what his chances were of being captured alive, the trooper would have said zero. And friends and family say the same thing. You know, Bucky's not going to allow himself to be arrested. He's going to commit suicide by cop. You know, if he wanted to just be peacefully go back to jail, he'd have done it a long time ago. So anyway, because Longobardo has passed away from the bleeding out from his leg wound, Bucky's now a cop killer. And what ensues is the largest manhunt in New York State history until Matt and Sweat escaped from Dannemora a few years later. Personnel were taken away from community-oriented campaigns, anti-drug campaigns, anti-gang campaigns in the cities of New York State, all to join the hunt for Bucky Phillips, who after all these months remained only one man. And the hunt now drifted out of New York State and into northern Pennsylvania. And it was not just growing larger, but it was getting smarter as well. Troopers on both sides of the state line had become aware of a pattern. Bucky stole cars and moved at night. So they suspected he had hideouts that they still didn't know about and that those locations were very close to the state line. So they concentrated on area roads between midnight and dawn, and it couldn't go on forever. There came a day when the hunters established a perimeter and Bucky was indeed inside it. They tightened the circle until they could see him. Friends and family were ready to start grieving because Bucky's days were numbered. But another surprise. Bucky'd had enough. He could see the SWAT team. The helicopter was directly overhead. And so he walked out of the woods very close to Ackley, New York, and into a clearing with his hands up. And with news of the capture, the residents of Ackley lined the streets and cheered wildly as a motorcade of law enforcement vehicles withdrew from the area. Now, after his capture, Bucky said he was sorry about the trooper that got killed. He was sorry about the trooper that got shot, both of them. But for the most part, he was proud of himself. He pulled it off. Man, he had everybody on the run there for a while.
Yeah.
And that's the Bucky Phillips story. Bucky's still with us. surprisingly.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Michael, to stop for a second for our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find? Sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design make taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential for Men 50+ about 8 months ago when it became available for men and teens. I decided to try it because my wife Lisa has been taking Ritual for over a year, and she was impressed with the results of taking Ritual daily. She felt it made a significant difference in her health, and I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into bioavailable vitamin and mineral sources sold me on Ritual. They are a superior multivitamin. Ritual is the multivitamin reimagined. A multivitamin should contain key nutrients and forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in the diet with no shady extras. Ritual's delayed-release capsule design delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, Michael, we've just talked about the incredible escape story, Run, Bucky, Run. You have a story included, Flossie Wilbur Vanishes. Before we talk about the Genesee Junction murders, which I know is incredibly personal to you, with George Ann Formicola and Kathy Bernhardt being your friends. But let's just briefly mention the story of Flossie Wilbur Vanishes.
Well, like I said before, this is the second story in the book in which the murder victim had no friends. The lady on the internet alerted me to this story, and the second I started reading about it, I knew I wanted to put it in the book. In 1985, a 75-year-old woman named Flossie Wilbur disappeared. She was the least liked person in all of Angelica, New York. Angelica is a former railroad town and home to maybe 1,000 people. There's a chance that she was the least liked person in the state of New York. You know, maybe only Jim Tan was a competitor.
Yeah.
To know her, apparently, was to hate her. Flossie was a formidable presence, a bundle of negative energy. She's 5'6", 160 pounds, and she looked like she could handle herself, you know, not like a 75-year-old woman at all. She looked like she could kick your butt. She's usually dressed in roughed-up dungarees, work shoes, flannel shirt, and she always carried some sort of club. It wasn't a baseball bat, but it had a similar shape. Maybe it was a table leg. No one was really sure, but she looked like she could put it upside your head if she wanted to. And she was a bitter, hostile woman who combined a nasty disposition with anger management issues to pretty much guarantee she was always alone, which most people believed was the way she wanted it. Now, here's a stat. There are at least 2 people who left Angelica because they didn't want to live in the same village with Flossie Wilbur. Ed and Kay Eicher had split town, and Flossie was the reason. Ed and Kay had appreciated the beauty of Angelica and offered their home to the Fresh Air Kids program, in which kids from the inner city got to have some fresh air in the summer by moving in with a volunteer family in the country. Well, Flossie was racist to the bone. Who saw that coming? Everybody. She was bigoted down to her toes, and she saw the black kid playing with white kids next door, and she went nuts. She used every racist vulgarity she could muster. She harassed the Eichers, and it wasn't just verbal abuse. The Eichers would go out, and they'd come home to find their home vandalized, smeared in rotten fruit.
Wow.
So, poof. On August 24th, 1985, Flossie had to go shopping for a few necessities. She got in her car and drove to the Village Market on Main Street. She didn't have to go very far. She lived on Main Street, only about 200 yards to the west. It was an easy walk unless you're getting groceries, so she took the car. She had a new car, 1985 Ford Escort, and was looking for opportunities to use it. At the store, she bought her groceries, put them in the car, and drove away, and that was the last time anyone saw her, except for her killer, of course. When Flossie hadn't picked up her newspaper for 6 days, the two-man Angelica police force performed a wellness check, and Flossie was gone, plucked from life. She was apparently still bringing groceries into the house from the car. Some were in the house, some were still in the car. And police could do nothing but scratch their heads and search, but Flossie was nowhere to be found. And canvassed Main Street and talked one time to another to all of Flossie's nearest neighbors. And the more people came in contact with Flossie, the more they hated her guts. So the number of suspects was lengthy. One man, a 42-year-old named David Shirk, he was a tall and lanky local antique dealer, told cops, "Flossie once threw feces at my house." I think the point here is that the town's all shook up, but they're not grieving. Nobody's sad, but they are afraid that whatever happened to Flossie could happen to them too, so they're afraid. One woman said that she remembered once she was playing with the kids who lived next door to Flossie, and Flossie came out and pointed a shotgun at them. I'm thinking that might be the same incident with the fresh air kids from the inner city. But anyway, it was like that up and down the street. Who had a motive? Everybody had a motive. And just as in the Bucky Phillips story, where the slogan had been, "Where is Flossie?" In Angelica, the catchphrase was now, "Where's Flossie?" Instead of "Run, Bucky, run." So there were those who preferred to think that Flossie just wandered off and may someday wander back. But most looked at the facts and saw a woman who'd been, stolen from her life. People locked their doors and nobody sat out on the front porch anymore. Now we skip ahead 30-odd years. To 2019, and there's a break in the Flossie Wilbur case. It's unbelievable. Her killer, on his deathbed, confesses to the crime and gives authorities a location to search for her body. Now, the killer turned out to be David Shirk, who was the antique dealer who said that Flossie thrown feces at his house.
That's right.
Police knew about him all along. He was one of many who might have done it. And he took credit for it on his deathbed. The problem is you couldn't really sew it up because when they went to look for Flossie's body, they found an area that had been flooded out repeatedly in the 30 years since she would have been buried there, and they didn't find her body. He was supposed to be in the vicinity of the Almond Dam, and they couldn't find her. So veterans of the Where's Flossie investigation said that Shirk's confession didn't come as a complete surprise. He was apparently mentioned in her diary quite a bit as a neighbor she was having particular problems with. She said mean things about him. She called people half-breeds, bums, and idiots. And Shirk, before he could give any other further information about the crime, died on April 14th, 2019, at the age of 76. And I guess we'll call that case closed. There's no reason for him to lie. Deathbed confessions are usually taken as good evidence. And the fact that they couldn't find the body had a natural excuse.
Mm-hmm.
But Wilbur Flossie, she's they're still wondering where she is in Angelica, New York.
And she really did vanish, it seemed. Before we talk about the Genesee Junction murders, this is an incredible story, this murder of Tabitha Bryant. Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, at around midnight, July 13th and 14th, 2003, Monroe County Sheriff's Office gets a 911 call that's different from any other call they can remember. caller is a man named Kevin Bryant. He is calling from the living room of his Penfield, New York home. He says that he was upstairs in bed. He was reading a Tom Clancy novel when someone came into his house and murdered his wife. She'd been shot. He said he and his wife had 2 boys, 3 and 5 years old, and they were in their room asleep. The 911 operator asked Kevin to check his wife for a pulse, which he did, and reported that his wife was dead. Now, the reason it was different from any other call is that 911 operators are used to dealing with people who are in just absolute panic. And Kevin Bryant was calm, was collected. He seemed maybe a little bored. Sounded as if he yawned at one point. Now, when law enforcement arrives, they're immediately struck by Kevin Bryant's size. He's a tiny man, stood only an inch or two above 5 feet. He'd been sick as a kid. He'd had many heart surgeries. And the police, even the police women who were there, towered over him, and they took him to the end of his driveway and started to question him. And again, we're much like in the Charlie Tan case. We're on a nice street with beautiful homes. This time we're in Penfield, New York, which is Pittsburgh-like in its toniness. Mm-hmm. So he tells police he grew up in Penfield, graduated from Penfield High in 1976, got his law degree from Vermont Law. Now he was a lawyer, had an office on Ridge Road out in the town of Greece. And he admitted that he and his wife had contemplated divorce just the previous Friday. He said his wife was named Tabitha Marie Bryant. She was 26 years old. He was 45. They were married in 1997. They'd known each other for many years because they belonged to different branches of the Community of Christ Church. He had been her divorce lawyer after a short-lived marriage to a high school sweetheart didn't work out. They had troubles. She had a boyfriend, a guy named Keith Cromwell. Maybe he's the one who did it, Kevin suggested, hopefully. Kevin, of course, was an instant suspect. The husband always is. But with the exception of blood on the 2 fingertips where he checked Tabitha's pulse, there was no blood on him, and the killer would have had to have been a bloody mess. Police were baffled. There was no sign of forced entry, no sign of burglary. The husband said he didn't see the killer. By the time he made it to the top of the stairs, looked down into the living room, the killer was already out of the house and in his car, which noisily drove away. Plus, and nobody likes to talk about this, but plus, there was semen on the body, semen that has never been identified. Now, Tabitha graduated from high school in 1995 and soon thereafter married her high school sweetheart. Her husband wore the same tux to the wedding that he'd worn to the prom.
Wow.
He took a job in the town of Avon, which is a southern suburb of Rochester, and Tabitha moved out of her hometown for the first time, and they began to fight almost immediately. She contacted Kevin, the only lawyer she knew, and Kevin, licking his chops, told Tabitha that he would be glad to help her with her divorce. And, of course, she would need a place to stay. He had a big, empty house. Maybe she could move in with him. She said, sure. And at first she slept in the guest room, but before the divorce was final, she'd moved again, this time into the master bedroom and Kevin Bryant's large bed. Now, Kevin and Tabitha were wed on December 26, 1997. That's about a year after her first wedding. For reasons that are unclear, she wore red spike high heels as she walked down the aisle to join Kevin at the altar.
Mm-hmm.
At first, Kevin and Tabitha seemed like an ideal couple. Kevin's family and church friends were, to put it bluntly, relieved when he, being a lifelong bachelor, had finally taken a wife. The church was very conservative, spinoff of Church of Latter-day Saints, and men were restricted to one wife, of course, by American law, but the church taught that the wife should be obedient.
Right.
So Kevin had never had a steady girlfriend before Tabitha came along. And the rumor was that Kevin's sex life consisted of hiring local sex workers for parties in suburban motels. And even after he was married, Kevin continued to see prostitutes. He took his new bride to strip joints, one in particular in the town of Henrietta, where he enjoyed watching his new bride give other men lap dances. This is very odd behavior.
Sure.
Now, this evolved into Kevin and Tabitha taking part in group sex activities, and maybe she enjoyed it, maybe she didn't, but at least at first, she didn't think she had a choice in the matter. Her job as a wife was to obey her husband. Their church said so. So this is the way things are going when Tabitha's half-brother, Cyril Weinbrenner, who's same mom, different dad, called up Tabitha, said that, you know, his brother, her half-brother, had just been killed in a car accident. His wife and kid had left him, and he had a nervous breakdown and ended up in a mental institution with amnesia. Would it be okay if she would help him remember who he was? Well, I don't know how much of that was malingering, probably a lot of it. But Tabitha says, oh, my, you must come live with us. We have this big house. So Cyril moves in. Kevin gives Cyril a job working in his office. And our cast is completed by Cassidy Green, who is Monroe County's tiniest sex worker. She's 4'10", weighs 76 pounds, and her street name is Baby Doll. Now, if a man wanted to imagine himself with a child, she could pretend she was a child. But in reality, she was 22 years old, and she became Cyril Weinbrenner's girlfriend and moved into the Bryant home. So Kevin, after living alone, has now put together this little family. He's got a wife. He's got a brother-in-law, his brother-in-law's girlfriend, couple of kids. You know, he has a family now, which he's enjoying dragging through the carnal mud of, you know, sex parties and strip joints. Cassidy became Tabby's babysitter when Tabitha worked as a teller at a branch bank. Cassidy and Cyril developed overwhelming cocaine addictions. Although Kevin couldn't use cocaine because of his bad heart, he always had a bunch on hand, which he used to control people. And that, you know, it's fairly common with men who are regular consumers of prostitutes, because
sure,
sex workers do not have long attention spans, and a couple of lines of coke will sometimes keep them interested a little while longer. So anyway, Tabitha's just born two kids. She's pleased her church. She's fooling everybody. She thinks everybody thinks she's happy and enjoying her role as a lawyer's wife. She's not happy. Kevin doesn't seem to like her. He likes having a hot young wife, but he doesn't like her. He takes her out. He makes her writhe on top of strange men. And perhaps it serves Kevin right, but one night, Tabitha is sitting on the lap of a man named Keith Cromwell, and she and Keith hit it off. For one thing, Keith's a normally sized man. And he's also older. I mean, Tabitha does have a type. He's the same age as Tabitha's mother. So her boyfriend and her husband are both a generation older than she is. But finally, you know, Kevin figures out something's going on. He hires a private detective. Private detective follows Tabitha, comes back with photos of Tabitha and her boyfriend kissing and holding hands. Now, immediately, Kevin starts thinking about having Tabitha killed. Because she's disobeying him. She is humiliating him. She is making him cuckold. And it doesn't matter how many sex partners he's had during their marriage. The fact that she has a boyfriend and is without his permission means she's being disobedient. And he starts asking around, you know, drug dealers and sex workers if they know anybody who might be willing to bump somebody off for him.
Yeah.
Now, 1 week later, Tabitha's dead, shot and stabbed under a ceiling fan that is dripping gore. So the story has to do with, well, what the heck happened? And, you know, the last hint I'll give you is the contract's finally taken by Cyril Weinbrenner, who's so strung out and desperate for money that he agrees to kill his sister in exchange for $5,000 in cocaine money. And Cassidy, after he cuffs her around a little bit, agrees to drive the getaway car. So of all the motives for murder that I've written about, perhaps I needed cocaine money, so I killed my sister, is the weakest.
Yeah.
So that's the Tabitha Bryan. And Tabitha, by the way, is the pretty young woman who's on the cover of the book.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, that he has this the excuse that he kills his sister. But at first, when Kevin describes the crime scene for police, saying that these intruders came in, it does not fit whatsoever with the gore and the crime scene itself. And so immediately he's a suspect, which leads eventually through this incredible story to Cyril Weinbrenner and his culpability in this, incredibly.
Well, yeah, when Kevin says that the killer's gone by the time I got to the top of the stairs,
mm-hmm.
what he's saying is, I stayed in bed and I listened as this guy killed my wife, and I waited until he was gone before I got up and went to see what was going on. Now,
yeah.
You know, the investigators didn't immediately say, well, that clinches that he must be responsible. What they said was, this guy's a coward. Now, his wife is clearly being attacked downstairs, and he calmly turns another page in his Tom Clancy novel before going to see what's up. He waited until he knew the danger was over before he got up. And as it turns out, all of it was pre-planned, and Kevin knew exactly who was downstairs and what was going on. Last thing he wanted to do was to catch him in the act.
Let's talk about this personal story to you, obviously, the
sure.
Genesee Junction murders. Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, you know, the Devil at Genesee Junction is, you know, maybe my all-time favorite book that I've written. I feel like in some sense I wrote it with my own blood. It's a memoir more than a true
right.
crime book. And it was published as a memoir, not as a true crime book. And it's often worried me that maybe I shortchanged my hardcore true crime audience by describing the 1966 portion of the story through the eyes of a 9-year-old boy.
I don't think so.
I decided to approach the murders again from a writing point of view, not from an investigative point of view, and to take me out of the picture and to tell it like a straight police story. So that's what I did. Eventually, I had to show up in the story because there comes a time when all further activity in the case stems from the alliance between Kathy Bernhardt's mom, Alice, and myself. As a 9-year-old boy, I'm basically a bystander and not that important to the story, except for the fact that I grew up to become a true crime writer. So June 25th, 1966, hot Saturday night in Chi-Line, New York, the first day of summer vacation, graduation night at the high schools, and along Ballantyne Road, two teenage girls were feeling restless. There was 14-year-old Georgianne Formicola and her 16-year-old friend Kathy Bernhardt. They didn't feel like being around adults, and so around 7:30, after asking permission from Kathy's mom, they went back to their favorite swimming hole at Black Creek for a quick cool down before dinner. Alice Bernhardt, Kathy's mom, told the girls it was okay with her, but to be back in an hour. And the truth of the matter was, she wasn't worried because Kathy was afraid of the dark. They were going to be back before it got too dark anyway.
Sure.
So the girls are wearing their brand new 2-piece bathing suits. Around Kathy's waist was tied a large beach towel with a cartoon picture of a woman wearing a bikini, sunglasses, and a sombrero on it. Kathy wore flip-flops. Georgianne was barefoot. Georgianne never wore shoes of any kind in the summertime. Now, these are the things I know because I was there. carrying her small red wrist-held transistor radio, her most prized possession. She'd never been anywhere without it. The radio, as always, was tuned into WBBF 950 on the AM dial and Rochester's coolest station. Coolest DJ, Queen Bee, Jessica Savage, was spinning the hits. And when the girls got to the swimming hole back by Black Creek, they were discouraged. Swimming and picnicking were Spanish-speaking people from the city of Rochester. So they didn't go in the water, and instead they kept walking along the tracks until they got to the old Genesee Junction, where the Penn Railroad crossed the west shore line of the New York Central. It used to be a major transportation hub, but by 1966, it's a ghost town. They took a right, and they walked on a gravel road as far as Scottsville Road, where they stopped briefly at a small tavern called the Castle Inn, where Kathy's father could often be found. They bummed some money, crossed the Ballantine Bridge over the Genesee River, and went into Coop's convenience store, where they bought Cokes and a pack of cigarettes. They crossed the bridge again, walked for a time southward along Scottsville Road, where a woman remembered seeing them. There was a rope on a tree where kids swung into the Genesee River, but the girls were unhappy with whoever was or wasn't at the swing. So they headed northward again and settled along the side of Black Creek at its confluence with the Genesee River. Now, fishing spot are the Witt family of Rochester. Bruce Witt told investigators that at approximately 7:30, he and his wife saw the girls, who they identified by photographs. They walked down to the creek bank. One of the girls took off her flip-flops, put her feet in the water. The other sat on the rocks. They were chatting and appeared in a happy mood. Witt said that at one point he was trying to cast his line into the center of the creek, and it was caught on the Scottsville Road Bridge railing. So he walks up the embankment to free his line, and when he's up there, he sees a 1955 or 57 Chevrolet pull over to the shoulder of the road on the bridge. And the car was beat up. It was dark green in color with either damage to the front end or a front grill that was missing. Something was wrong with the front of the car. A male youth in his early 20s, dark complexion, possibly of Italian extraction, got out of the vehicle, yelled to the two girls to come along. Whistled. Come on, come on. The girls got up, banked, and got into the vehicle, which then made a U-turn and headed north on Scottsville Road toward the city of Rochester. But before it got to the railroad crossing, it made another U-turn and then started driving back towards Witt and Black Creek. After that, the witness paid no further attention, and the girls were never seen alive again. Now, the tone of that makes me think those girls know that guy. He said, come on, and they were obedient to him. It was
right.
More like a friend or a family member. You know, come on, your mom needs you home. Anyway, at 3:30 p.m. on July 27th, that's about a month later, 43-year-old farmer Vincent Zuber smells a rich odor, thinks one of his cows died, goes to investigate on his tractor, and finds the bodies of the girls off of a lover's lane that runs along the same railroad tracks that the girls had walked along during their last hours. Both bodies were found face up, about 15 feet apart, and the lane next to which the bodies were located led to worked farm fields, and were noted mostly for being used by local young people as a place for necking in cars. For George Ann, Dr. Green Dyke, the medical examiner, found 5 penetrating incised wounds of her interior, 2 stab wounds of her left arm, 4 stab wounds to her perineum. There were incised wounds to her neck with partial transection of her cervical vertebrae. In other words, he cut off her left breast and cut her throat so deeply that she was almost beheaded, and stabbed her multiple times in a cluster on and around her vagina. Now, for Kathy, she had 3 penetrating incised wounds of the interior thorax, 2 stab wounds at her right arm and hand, sharp excision of both breasts and perineum. In other words, she had both breasts removed. She had her bladder and uterus removed. And she also had many stab wounds throughout her body like George Ann, all from the front. And because there were wounds to the girls' arms and hands, these were seen as defensive wounds, a sign that the girls had been attacked suddenly and probably killed before they were sexually mutilated. Girls' bathing suits had been put back on following the surgery, but only to cover up the areas where parts had been removed. Therefore, Kathy had both the tops and bottoms of her bathing suit on, while Georgianne's top had been put back on, but her bottoms were found nearby. Kathy had the most sexual mutilation, but it was Georgianne who had almost been beheaded. From then on, the story in Rochester's Most Startling Crimes is an examination of the suspects. You know, is it Jack Starr, Georgianne's hot-headed boyfriend, who wanted to marry her? Is it Arthur Shawcross, who we've talked a lot about today? Did he come back to Rochester later and mutilate corpses in the same way that these were mutilated? Was it John Miller, a fellow from Pennsylvania who had a thing about killing girls in bathing suits with a knife? Or was it Clint Wilson, the pseudonym? And we don't use the pseudonym to protect him. We use the pseudonym to protect his family, many of whom we love and have been cooperative with us over the years. Clint Wilson, married to Georgianne's cousin and a serial rapist. And Clint also had a greaser brother, Keith, who could have passed for Italian and been the man on Scottsville Road who said, come along. Clint and Keith are not only from a really, really bad family of serial criminals, but they're also in Georgianne's family. Clint is Kathy's neighbor and married to Georgianne's first cousin. Keith is married to Georgianne's sister. So they're in and out of the former Cola house all the time. We don't have to imagine how they met. They knew each other. But we eventually conclude that Clint and Keith are the best suspects just because proximity. We know they're in the area at the time. We know that they're mean enough to do it. And because of intrigue involving the illegitimate baby that Georgianne had when she was had just turned 14, we think that there's a pretty strong motive that it was the Wilson brothers as well. And that's it. That's Rochester's Most Startling Crimes. And intriguingly, at one point, I wrote Volume 1. So there might be a Volume 2 coming down the pike, but it will be post-pandemic.
You include an interesting story called Angel Lounge.
Yes.
It's very, very interesting, and the end is very, very interesting. So I did ask you if this was a story that was going to be continued, and
That's the end of the story. Angel Lounge is a true story. It's from the 1963 murders of two police officers in Lodi, New Jersey. And I wrote about it initially, not because I had anything to do with Rochester, but because I thought that it would make a good movie. So I didn't write it like a true crime story. I wrote it like a movie treatment. It's in the present tense. It's very immediate. There's some condensation of character and time that I probably would not have allowed myself in other circumstances. So slightly fictionalized. You know, there's a character in there who doesn't really exist, so I can have him do all of the things that the police did that they don't want attributed to them. We have a fictional character who absorbs all of that for them. And the ending is designed to be an intriguing ending and not necessarily where the story itself ends. But I'll tell you the story. In 1963, two police officers are humiliated, tortured, and murdered in the Angel Lounge in the town of Lodi. They heard a gunshot, went in to investigate, and were forced to strip and kneel. They were pistol-whipped and eventually shot to death. One of the murderers was killed within days by police in a wild scene in a Manhattan hotel. He died with his pants off, just like the cop he killed. The other murderer turned himself in while accompanied by a beautiful female lawyer, and that began a really strange saga in American justice, because that man was Tom the Rabbi Trantino, who claimed to recall only being a witness to the murder, said he had no recollection of participating in any way, and that despite the fact that multiple eyewitnesses saw him, you know, helping the murder of both policemen. So Trantino was sentenced to die, but that sentence was then commuted to life, and during his four decades, Trantino proved himself to be a Renaissance man. He created surrealist art that was exhibited in Asia and Europe, and he wrote and illustrated two books, and he was doing all these things even as friends and families of the murdered cops screamed for his execution. So some are screaming he should be executed, some are screaming he should be set free because he would be a contributor to society. And rarely do you hear a dichotomy quite that wide. And like I said, this is experimental prose for me. If you don't like it, you can skip it. It's a few pages at the end of the book. But it's written in present tense, very cinematic. And it has a catch ending that Dan Zapansky thought might mean a sequel.
Well, it's an incredible story involving these police, too, because we have a couple stories in here with that. And just incredible, this story here with these guys tortured. And, of course, when police are shot or wounded or the police react. In this other story, you talk about 65 law enforcement agencies being involved, the reward going from $50,000 to almost $400,000. So in this particular case, when cops are murdered, humiliated, and tortured, you have a response from law enforcement, don't you?
Oh, boy, yeah. Absolutely. It borders on vigilantism.
Yeah, certainly. I want to thank you so much, Michael, for coming on and talking about Rochester's most startling crimes. It certainly has been Rochester's most startling crimes. For people that want to take a look at your other books, I know there's 18 other true crime books that you list. They would go to an Amazon page. Is that the deal?
Amazon.com. I'm the Michael Benson with the white beard.
Yes, absolutely.
You'll even find some of my old, when I was a sports writer, I wrote a book about the Grateful Dead. Whatever you like. I've been at this a long time. But the two new ones in addition to this have nothing to do with Rochester. I wrote The Wicked King Wicker about the Son of Sam, and The Age of Zodiac about the Zodiac Killer in Northern California, and the pair seem to be doing pretty well.
Absolutely, deservedly so. So thank you very much, Michael Benson, Rochester's
Thanks,
most startling crimes. Been a pleasure. Thank you.
You have a great summer, buddy.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.